Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what, I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3, here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
Before. It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best of new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X.
Morning, welcome to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms. You've got Julian Paul here live as usual. If you listen on catch up, it is Saturday the 11th of April 2026. This episode will be repeated next Saturday, the 18th of April, all being well. And then we'll be back in the studio on Saturday, the 25th of April, with a Life Science Radio Show special edition, Construction and Housing Delivery, Factory in a Box System. We'll be joined live in the studio by Richard Crosby, who's the director of Seismic Group, and Professor Ben Hughes, who's University of Sheffield School of Mechanical, Aerospace and Civil Engineering. Special thanks to our Chris Dale, our regular guest speaker every fourth Saturday of the month, for arranging this interview for us on the 25th of April. And all being well, our PG will also be in the studio leading the interview, so we don't have to ring him up, fingers crossed. We will be ringing him up later in this hour. Also, our guest speaker this week, and indeed every second Saturday of the month, is Dr. Ogo Osamo. All being well, he'll be talking to us briefly about vehicle fuels. Hot topic, but not the politics of it. Bit of science behind it. Next up, Paul's going to talk about the new way to make a jacket. Use potato.
Yes, the textiles industry is in trouble, but the humble British spud could save it. Cotton, the mainstay of the textiles industry, is struggling in the face of climate change and drought. Half of cotton growing regions are expected to be hit by 2040. But a British startup has identified the potato as the solution. FIBE, that's a company called FIBE, FIBE, a company formed in 2020 by four Imperial College London students, has worked out a method to use the stalks from potato crops to make clothing. The plant's foliage is poisonous to animals, so is usually composted or burnt. Idan Gal Shohet, 25, a co-founder of FIBE, said the idea was to take this waste product from the fifth most grown crop in the world and find a use case for it. Cotton is a thirsty drop, no, sorry, a thirsty crop, I've got a fold in my piece of paper, got into a thirsty crop with a single T-shirt requiring 3,000 litres of water to make the hot climates. The hot climates that cotton requires are increasingly facing drought. Gal Shohet said the alternative uses 99.7% less water. The relatively low fibre contents of potato stalks meant Fibe had to develop processes to mechanically separate the fibres, which the team believed was 4 to 5 times more efficient than traditional methods. Investors are increasingly convinced by the approach. Patagonia's investment arm, the Tin Sheds Ventures, is among those who have put up £1 million, and the Royal Academy of Engineering has given a £3 million grant via the Green Future Fellowship to establish a pilot plant.
Interesting, because we talked about mushrooms the other week as well, mycelium leather. So the vegetables are coming to the fore. All good stuff, eh? Another story I picked up on, Startup Hopes, another startup, this time from Cambridge, though. Startup Hopes to banish range anxiety with a 5-minute electric vehicle charge. So a startup at Cambridge University has created an electric vehicle battery that can be charged from 10 to 80% in 10 minutes. Sai Shivareddy, the co-founder and chief executive of NioBolt, said that its batteries could be on the road within the next few years. The battery being tested is one of a kind prototype. It's been tested in a prototype car. It was an important proof of concept. It shows it's possible to bring convenience back to motoring, that you can top up an electric vehicle almost instantly. For a typical family petrol car with a 50-litre tank, filling from empty to full takes 75 to 90 seconds. By contrast, one of the fastest charging electric cars on sale, which is the Lotus Emeya, if you can afford it, I suspect, claims to reach 80% charge in 14 minutes under ideal conditions. But those speeds can be achieved only with powerful 350 kilowatt chargers. They're increasingly common at service stations, but owners must learn where they are and plan routes accordingly. Now, BYD, the Chinese company that has become the world's biggest EV maker, has developed a much quicker charging system using a 1,500 kilowatt charger, which is vastly more powerful than any other operating at present in the UK. BYD claims its new Denza Z9 GT can take its large high-range battery from 10% to 70% in 5 minutes. So using this infrastructure, NioBolt says its technology would be even quicker. Charging a battery involves pushing lithium ions into a component known as the anode. The problem is that the faster you do that, the more resistance builds. Heat rises, energy is wasted, and the battery degrades. So BYD and this Cambridge University startup NioBolt have found ways around this, in part by redesigning the anode, using new graphite materials. The trade-off is a lower energy density, meaning that batteries must be bigger to store the same amount of power. And although China is building flash charging hubs with the power requirements of market towns, the UK is constrained by an ageing grid and years-long waiting list for connections to it. For now, NioBolt is focusing on settings where power supplies are more reliable. Through a deal with Symbotic, it was a robot manufacturer, its batteries are powering thousands of autonomous robots in warehouses for Walmart, the US retailer. These machines are microcharged for just a few seconds each time they pick up or drop off a box. Fantastic article there about NioBolt, a startup at Cambridge University, looking to banish range anxiety on your EV car. great track there from Suede Electricity, because we're talking about a startup that hopes to banish range anxiety with a 5-minute EV charge. Watch this space. If you've just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. So what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Oh, bits and pieces, but I think a starter is close to home, Sheffield University. They've been involved in a study looking at the supply lines for integrated circuits. And they've done a study across several countries. Who are suppliers, and most of the production now is out to places like Taiwan and China. So it's been what was called offshored, cheapened in a lot of respects by sort of setting it up outside and remotely. But sort of key components they were following were two basic sort of commodities which go by the acronym INGAP. And INGON, and that's indium gallium phosphide, which is the INGAP, and indium gallium nitride, which is the INGAN, and they're key for making things like LEDs. So the INGAP is in use for making the sort of blue light LEDs, which are used a lot for communication, signalling, music, and lots of other uses for that. INGAN, and what they're saying is through this study, they've done it in sort of a block of years, so they've done 2030, 2040, 2050, what will global impacts on supply chains be, what will be the demands, and basically looking at that, they said it's time that the US and the UK took back semiconductor production back into the country, which is kind of sort of interesting for me because obviously I had a background in dealing with electronics, and I saw like a lot of industries in the UK, once they get to a certain size, the UK doesn't seem to be able to sort of maintain those companies. So we still have got some semiconductor producing companies, but quite often once they become significant, they'll migrate to the USA, of course, but the UK doesn't seem to sustain it. And I think it's one of those things. Again, we've seen a sort of reflection of it in things like the steel industry. And they've both got a sort of a driving force underneath, which is that if you don't maintain the production process and it breaks down for any reason, so in the case of steel, if you shut down the furnaces, it's not just as simple as pressing a button and lighting them again. It takes a lot of effort to get them back on stream correctly. Same with semiconductor manufacturing. You're continually developing product and sort of tailor-making it. So it's kind of interesting, but for me, I think it's good news that we're taking back some manufacturing. We should be taking back manufacturing. We should be supporting things like steel, because it's such an integral part of our futures. Mm. And these semiconductors are in a huge range of things, from phones through, say, entertainment and lots of other things. So, interesting study. I think it was Coventry and Sheffield University who undertook the study, but if you go on to Sheffield University news site, you can read that in a bit more detail. And then I watched a couple of TV things, which in the light of what I've just been saying, there was a programme about a regenerative farm in Australia. And we have people in the UK who are trying to start with regenerative farming. And we've covered things from Sheffield University, like the a proposal to put ground granite onto fields, and that will promote growth and reduce the need for fertilisers. So in a lot of respects, it's going back to the roots of farming. But what they were showing is that in Australia, particularly because of climate change, one of the key bits in the regenerative farming was the control and retention of water. So they basically looked at the way their water comes through the sort of terrain, and then put interventions like channels in to collect the water, slow its sort of passage through the soil so that it lasts for longer to support farming growth. And then in terms of the sort of second part, because they got the water, they could promote growth of grasses. And once the grass was growing, they could bring in cattle. And the cattle, and across the world, places use oxen, cattle, and various sort of animals. They will graze in that green field, but they'll also fertilise it as they go along. And they will turn over the soil, so it starts to regenerate. And intensive farming's got this problem that that you pour on nitrates to aid growth, but eventually you exhaust the soil. So regenerative farming, it's a great thing. Again, if you want to have a look on the BBC sort of website, you can find that article and have a look at regenerative farming, which is a way of sort of taking us back to the roots of farming and trying to readopt those rather than the intensive farming that we've done for quite a while. So I found that quite interesting. And then I was kind of stumped by another program that came up. And I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. Didn't ring a bell with me, but it was a program about desert kites. And if you don't know what the desert kites are, your brain starts to run through thinking, well, what are they doing, flying kites in the desert? No, don't know. What is it? So desert kites were apparent in some places through Southwest Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia and Arabia. But really, after the First World War, the RAF moved out into the areas that the UK got some control or some relationship with and put aircraft into those places. Those aircraft went up, and while they were flying around, they started to notice things on the ground. And the thing that they noticed was a rock formation that looked like the bottom part of a traditional kite shape. So effectively a tunnel shape. And the program was about the archaeological teams who are investigating desert kites. And a desert kite, as I was saying, looks a little bit like the sort of bottom part of a kite, looks like a funnel. And they were wondering what these were about, so investigating them. They said that basically they're stone structures with a convergent shape, but it's composed of linear piles of stones. And they've got lengths that range from 100 metres to several kilometres. heights that are less than a metre tall, even accounting for erosion. There are often gaps in the lines, which have got some other purpose, maybe. But the alignments are cames rather than a continuous row. So a number of different shapes are referred to as desert kites. The common features of all of these has got two walls, which they dubbed antennae. They converge into an enclosure, which is the head, and on the head there are attached cells. So if you imagine the kite shape, down towards the point, you start to find these circular structures that are around the point of the kite shape. But the kite shapes can be quite irregular, and really the sort of hypothesis that they came up with is that this was something to do with hunter-gathering, and saying that basically we're talking about sort of 11,000-12,000 years ago plus, and what was happening, hunter-gatherers, rather than chasing around the terrain, were building these structures to funnel prey down towards these circular structures. And what they found about the circular structures, which they thought at first may have been some kind of habitation or something like that, was that they were actually very deep pits, and sort of 3 meter deep pits. And the whole premise of the kites was to have prey coming in through the wide end of the funnel, driving them down to the point, and at the point, sufficient numbers of animals would drop into these pits that they could then be captured, killed, and made use of. So the research was published in 2022, and it says that the pits can be several metres deep at the margins of the enclosures, and they're saying that these are traps or killing pits. And the kites enclose surface areas with a range from something like 10,000 square metres, but much larger and also much smaller sizes are known. And they're typically found in areas with an elevated but flat topography and complex terrain, but they're rare or absent from sloping terrain. So why would that be? And what they found in looking at some occupation pits that weren't immediately attached to this kite structure was when they got into there were huge amounts of animal bones which looked to be antelope bones. So one of the things that came out of the study was the places where they occur were also on the natural migratory route for some antelopes. And when massive herds of antelopes are migrating, looking for new pastures, they will come along the line where these desert kites have been found. So it's really sort of it's quite stunning listening to it, because it kind of predates our thoughts about the abilities of human beings or humanoids to build those kind of structures. And you're talking about kilometres of effectively dry stone walling to create the sides of a desert kite, and then constructing the pits to trap the animals, and then some accommodation for people where they can process those animals. So the hunter-gatherers sort of, in my mind, went from being sort of small groups of people wandering around to this very productive use of terrain. And what sort of modern-day sort of observers have seen with antelopes is when they are running in herds, they tend to follow lines in the environment. So they'll follow paths or the edge of trees or things that sort of run, and they will run along that line. So they're forming these walls, which only have to be about a metre high, to give the line that the animals tend to cling towards. So they'll funnel down that. Some of the desert kites have got early parts and spurs running off with traps, but the focus is to drive a herd down towards these pits to capture and kill them. So they sort of tried radiocarbon dating and eventually optically stimulated luminescence. And that gave a range that's from the early Holocene period, which is about 12,000 years ago. And those kites are the most complex man-made structures of the time.
Wow. I thought you were going to talk about birds, Paul, when you started. I'm like, oh, desert kites. Is this a bird? Are you going to tell us it's extinct or something, or it's been reintroduced? But no, I didn't see that coming at all.
No, and I didn't. So I was totally engaged with this. Again, it's on the BBC website, if you want to pick up on it. But say they're known from the Middle East and Central Asia, but they're also found in Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Armenia, Turkey, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Egypt, and Libya. So this is a fantastic sort of human endeavour, which I didn't know anything about.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it, what you find out and what you pick up on.
There's around about 6,000 known kites.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. And they've even been found in Mongolia and South Africa. So it's something that sort of these hunter-gatherers have learnt by being familiar with the terrain. And they said that quite often the pits to capture them had a wall which was about a metre high. And it only needed to be that because in combination with the flat terrain, when the animal's running forward, when it gets close to that, it looks like it's something that you could jump over. So basically that tempted them to jump over the wall and down into the pit. So obviously they've got to have a real good understanding of the animals and the things that affected them to come up with the idea. And when they started to look in the habitation places, they started to find stone implements and also little stone statuettes, a rock shaped to look like a small sheep, and other things among that. They found the evidence of hearths for cooking. But they found these upright slabs, which they wondered what they were. And when they studied them, they found that apart from having animals depicted and other things, they found these petroglyphs that stand up. There's a stone standing upright. And strangely enough, once they studied it, they found that they were a representation of the desert kite that this accommodation related to.
Oh.
So it's one of the earliest forms of mapping known to man.
Fascinating, Paul. Where do you get it from, eh? BBC?
Oh, I just say, for me, it just
catches
sort of
your eye, yeah.
Yeah, but something I didn't know about, and you see the sort of combination of circumstances, and the name Kites was actually bestowed on them by a Royal Air Force pilot, Group Captain Lionel Rees, whose reference said that they resembled toy kites. Said they're commonly found in desert areas and later became known as desert kites, which is now the commonly used term for
Brilliant. Absolutely.
Wow.
Well, this show is all about science in all its different forms, Paul.
It's amazing. I love it. Really great. And I say, just astounding to see that that area of development wasn't really known until we started to look into the desert kites.
Yeah, amazing. I wonder if anybody can work out the crop circles then, Paul. There's a challenge for you. Ah. But you've chosen a brilliant piece of music, Paul, I have to say.
Yeah,
the Beatles.
Well, I give some credit to Paul as well for that.
Well, I found it actually, Paul, but
all right, well,
I'll let him have some credit
to
for
the
it.
Team, eh?
I'm going to play it.
Being for the benefit of Mr. Kite.
Lovely.
Bye bye, nice Paul. We'll speak to you Monday. Yeah. Glory's Rock Show 1 till 3. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Mr. Kite, there will be a show tonight on trampoline. The Hendersons will all be there, late of Pablo Bank is there, what a scene. Over men and horses, hoops and garters, lastly through a hogshead of real fire. In this way, Mr. K will challenge the world. Celebrated Mr. K performs his feat on Saturday at Bishop's Gate. The Hendersons will dance and sing as Mr. Kite flies through the ring. Don't be late. Mrs. K and H assure the public their production will be second to none. And of course, Henry the Horse dances the waltz. Without a sound. And Mr. H will demonstrate 10 somersets he'll undertake on solid ground. Ding ding, some days in preparation, a splendid time is guaranteed for all. And tonight, Mr. Kite is topping the bill.
Amazing track there from the Beatles, yeah. For the benefit of Mr. Kite, because RPG was talking about desert kites and actually came off Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band album. Amazing. If you've just tuned in, of course, you're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org. We should have Dr. Ogo Osimo on the line. Good morning, August, sir.
Good morning, Julie. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Thank you for joining us yet again, August.
No worries.
I know you're looking forward to this. I've set you a bit of a challenge, I think, haven't I, this time. But for people who don't know you are, August, you and I used to work together in the air quality team at Sheffield City Council.
Correct.
Didn't you? And your background is chemistry as well. So I just asked you a little question, sort of to talk a little bit about vehicle fuels. Now, foolishly, I thought sulfur was somewhere in the mix. when we start about talking about vehicle fuels. But so tell us, because petrol and fuels are hot topic at the minute, but we're not talking politics or supply. We're talking the science behind the fuels that we use and how it's changed in recent years, I guess.
Yes, the vehicle fuels we've used actually date back to the 18th, 19th century. If you remember, we started off using steam.
Yes.
For locomotion.
Yeah.
It meant having to burn coal or wood as fuel. So that generated steam and it was used to power the engines that they had at the time. But then those engines were bulky and inefficient as well. But they marked the beginning of, you know, mechanized transport, you know?
Yeah.
You would remember the A4 class A4 Mallard that holds the world speed record, you know,
for yes.
steam locomotives at 106 miles per hour.
Yeah.
Designed by Sir Nigel Greasley yes. in 1938.
From Doncaster.
Exactly.
Can you believe that? So close to home, eh?
So that was, the beginning of the use of, if you like, fuels. Wood and coal were the primary beginners. Anyway, as the invention of internal combustion engines came along in the 19th century, petrol, also known as gasoline in America anyway, and diesel emerged as the primary fuels. They became the ones largely used. Now, this development of internal combustion engines aided the development of a catalytic chemical process known as the Fischer-Tropsch process. It converts a mixture of carbon monoxide and hydrogen. If you remember, there used to be the term syngas. You might remember that, no?
Ooh, anyway. This is deep. Syngas. I'll go deep.
Heavy. Yeah.
So the carbon monoxide and hydrogen, the chemical process converts them into liquid hydrocarbons.
Wow.
Which we now know as diesel, for example, gasoline, or kerosene.
Wow. You see, this is how little I know, Ogul.
So it was two German scientists, Franz Fischer and Hans Tropsch, developed this system, hence the Fischer-Tropsch process, you know?
Wow.
They produce synthetic fuels, but the precursor, carbon monoxide and hydrogen, they're all syngas, you know? And their sources were from non-petroleum sources. So, you know, they get them from coal, from natural gas. Depending on how you treat the coal, it's a catalytic process, meaning there's catalysts involved in producing it. But anyway, rushing forward, you know, the petrol-powered cars then became widespread and, you know, used quite a lot, you know, because it meant lighter engines and ease of use as well. However, the diesel engines gained popularity because heavy vehicles were able to use them efficiently. Okay?
Yeah.
So the transition is from wood to diesel.
Oh, you're just breaking up a little bit, Ogo. It might be on our side, I don't know.
Yeah.
Try again.
Hello?
Yes, you're fine.
Right. Yeah, I was going to suggest actually using the landline. I wonder.
We might try that next time then. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You're much better now.
Okay now, dear.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So in the mid, 20th centuries, there was concern about efficiency and emissions to air, as you know, which is part of what you were, you know, referring to, and well worked together. That led to the development of alternative fuels, such as liquefied petroleum gas, LPG.
Yeah, remember that? We used to have a works van that worked on that before we got hydrogen van.
Yeah. Until it blew up.
You can't say things like that.
Liquefied petroleum gas, you know, which is mainly, what's it called again?
Liquid petroleum gas.
LPG. Yeah, that's right. It's mainly, the other one is methane, ethane, and then is the three carbon one. Butane, actually, is part of that LPG.
Oh,
it's compressed. It's liquefied. You know, when you compress it, you know, gas. Same thing with CNG, compressed natural gas. Compressed natural gas is methane in the main, and when you compress it, it becomes a liquid. You take the heat, you know, drop the temperature.
Was LPG cleaner then, better, environmentally speaking?
Not than what?
You know, you talk about...
It's cleaner and better than diesel.
Yeah.
And petrol. Yes, it is. Because there's only little, you know, number of carbons in LPG is less, far less compared to the number of carbons in petrol or diesel. Ah. Diesel has the biggest in terms of liquid fuels. Well, yeah. That's used for transportation. Diesel has the biggest number of, and also the structure of the carbon hydrogen in diesel. They're not all linear, whereas in LPG they're linear. In CNG it's just one carbon, which is, you know, methane really compressed.
Wow.
You see. So there was also the development of biofuels from ethanol. You remember? Developed from sugarcane?
Yes.
Excuse me. And then there's the biodiesel.
Which is like cooking oil, yes. Yes, it's all coming back.
Remembers that, yeah.
Fish and chips.
Yeah. So these are all introduced, you know, for sustainability reasons, you know.
Yes.
You know, derived from renewable sources, which is the other, you know, interest. You know, sustainability is a major, stuff. Then... environmental concerns and advances in technology have actually shifted us towards cleaner engines. So electric vehicles came along, powered by batteries. You know, can you hear me?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're listening intently, Ogo.
Right. Powered by batteries. And as you know, today is gaining quite a lot of popularity, you know, with lots of, especially, well, in Sheffield and across Britain anyway, there are lots of electric vehicles on the road. There are also engines that, you know, hybrids, for example, hybrid engines that combine petrol engines with electric motors.
Yeah, it's like, I always think of that as almost the best of both worlds, because obviously plug-in hybrid, it's just linked to the battery, isn't it? There's no fuel at all, but yeah. I guess technically that's the best for the environment, is it?
Well, the best for the environment really is electric, to be honest with you.
Yes.
Especially if it's going to be based on hydrogen fuel cell. Because with hydrogen fuel cell, first, you can produce the hydrogen through renewable sources, either solar energy or wind turbines.
Yes.
You take the energy drawn from these sources to undergo electrolysis, meaning splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen. So you save the hydrogen and then feed it into a fuel cell in a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. That fuel cell reconverts hydrogen back into water.
Yeah, this emissions are just water, aren't they, at tailpipe?
Yeah, just water, yeah. Now, as you know, here in Sheffield, electrolyzers are produced by a local company.
Yes, ITM, well, ITM Power. Yeah.
They have their origins locally. They're now an international company.
Amazing. And you said Sheffield, but actually, weren't they based at Rotherham, in the advanced manufacturing part, which is technically Rotherham?
No. Their production place now is no longer there.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
They moved to, what's Tinsley? It's Attercliffe, behind Attercliffe. What's that place called again? There's a road. If you travel from, I'm trying to remember the names now, I've forgotten them all.
Is it where the big... Is it off Shepcote Lane?
That's
a big industrial. They've moved there, have they? But yeah, they've become the Sheffield-based company, originally based at Advanced Manufacturing Park. But clearly, they've gone on to bigger and better things.
They started life at Brightside Lane, you know.
Yes,
they actually didn't.
It's still there on Brightside.
They're based at what you said was Rotherham location again.
Advanced Manufacturing Park.
Advanced Manufacturing, the base there was to exploit the wind turbine.
Yes, I remember. So they had a refueling station there, didn't they?
That's right. They produced a refueling station there, but their real origin was from Brightside Lane.
Yes.
And then, as things progressed and developed, they moved to Sheffield Lane.
Ah, yes. So that's for you as a chemist and an air quality expert. You would say that hydrogen is probably the sustainably created hydrogen, as you say, from wind or solar power, because there is different types of making hydrogen. That's the cleanest fuel in terms of local air quality.
Road transport. Vehicle,
yeah.
Yes.
Road transport.
And impact on the environment.
Yeah. So, you know, there was an interesting thing when we were working, Ogo, when, to be fair, a lot of people bought diesel cars. I think at the time maybe they thought it was cheaper, more economical, which you've alluded to. And, of course, heavy goods vehicles and buses need diesel anyway. So a lot of people were tempted to buy, or even the government perhaps promoted diesel as being more carbon friendly than petrol, say. Is that correct back then?
Yes, there was that, because at the time the focus was on reducing carbon emissions to air because of climate change.
Yes.
And the impact on health of vehicle emissions from diesel wasn't seriously considered
at that point in time. Recent, isn't it? So 2012, when maybe life changed.
Around about 2000. Now, there were people who raised issues at the time about, you know, political decisions and so on. Then it became more obvious that indeed. Before then, actually, the reason it was also first supported is that most of the heavy vehicle, engine transport tended to travel on, journey.
Yeah, and long journeys,
That's right. Diesels are well, suited for that type of transport or journeys. But interestingly, too, the emissions are not necessarily where people are concentrated.
Yes.
Because a lot of it, you're not too worried about, well, not that you're not too worried about, yeah, you're not too worried really about whether it's going to how the extent to which it impacts on people. Because by the time it travels to where people live, it would have disappeared into, you know, the background and so
on. I guess, you know, it's the impact of a lot of diesel vehicles in an urban area where you've got schools and lots of housing, isn't it?
Exactly.
Rather than somebody, a lorry company, basically doing most of its journeys on the actual motorway network or something, which is generally away from everybody.
That's correct, yes. And then the other thing then is that on those long distance journeys, economically, it's actually cheaper to use diesel, diesel fuels, because of, you know, the distance you can cover for, you know, the same.
Yeah. So yeah, it was an interesting one. There was quite a shift around, I think, 2012, when I recall the Euro. I think it was Euro 5, the Euro 5 car standard that people might remember. I think we're on Euro 6. Are we now?
We're Euro 7.
Oh,
now, Euro,
well, that shows how much I'm out of it. Then I'll go. But it's interesting because it transpired that Euro 5 engines were not performing as well as the manufacturers said they were on actual emission standards, and we're talking about nitrogen dioxide gas here, aren't we, in particular.
Yes.
And that's when the tide started to change, wasn't it? And you know, I'm glad at that point I'd got a petrol car, and still have, but I do cycle as well, in my defense. But so yeah, but isn't it, it's been an interesting transition in a very short space of time, really, hasn't it, from diesel to almost people not wanting diesel cars, but now you've got Euro 7 technology, maybe, and they're pretty good, aren't they?
They are. Yeah. Indeed, very good, yes.
But the government, you know, wants us to shift towards renewable sources, don't they?
That's right. The government has been kick-starting, as it were, you know, seed money provided here and there. People were encouraged, you know, to buy electric vehicles. And there are all kinds of support provided by government. And progressively, electric vehicles have come, are standing on their own, because the issue of range that used to be in terms of how much charge, you know, an engine can take you. The issue of range has progressively been improved. And you can get electric vehicles that take you 350 miles and so on without under one charge.
Yeah, and that's only going to... We talked earlier on in the show about a startup company who's looking to try and get a charger that can do it in 5 minutes. But that's in years to come. But it's like any technology. In years to come, it will have advanced and improved, won't it? But
And it's progressively improving,
So, but can I just ask you a few more questions before I let you go, Olga? If you have still got a petrol car, like I have, or we have, it's now we have to have E10 petrol. What's the difference between E10 and E5, though? Because what does that mean, if you know?
Right. It's about how the distance you can get, really, and the engine regarding the engine performance. E5 will give you a further distance compared to the E10. Now, it also depends on your car.
Oh, I think I might have lost you a little bit there, Ogo. That, I think it's our connection. It's a bit... Ooh.
Sorry?
It's all right. It's our fault, Ogo. It's our connection.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. I can.
Right. Yeah. The E10, it's the same petrol, but the quality of the E5 is better than...
Is it?
Yes, because, you know, your engine treats your engine better, takes you further as well.
So why is the government like promoted the E10 then? Is it more environmentally friendly or something?
The main difference that the government is promoting, E5, for example, contains about 5% ethanol.
Ah, this is what it is then.
That's what it is. And E10 contains up to 10% ethanol. So if you think about it, the 10% is actually better in the sense that you're using more renewable material.
I see. So the ethanol is the renewable bit, is it?
Yes.
Ah, clever.
So sometimes they've tested E15 as well, but performance is reduced.
Yeah, I think we've lost you a little bit, Ogo, but hang on a minute. I think it's just our connection.
Hello.
That's we're back. It's me. We're back. That's brilliant. Okay. So when you see the difference between E5 and E10 is basically the amount of ethanol in it, and the more ethanol, the more environmentally friendly your petrol is.
That's correct, because of the lower carbon dioxide emissions.
Wow. Right? Before I let you go, you've done a sterling job, to be fair. I've learnt a load here. What happened between, why did they remove lead from our petrol?
Right. As you indicated, I don't know, you've indicated that already. Lead is injurious to our health. It's dangerous. It's a heavy metal. And it's a metal that once it gets into our body, it's very slow at being got rid of.
Yeah.
And it eventually begins to affect nervous systems and so forth. But the reason it was added to fuel in the first place, as tetraethyl lead.
Wow.
Tetraethyl lead was to stop engines from knocking at the time.
Wow.
If you remember something called knocking.
I'm afraid I am old enough to remember, Ogo.
Okay. So that's why it was included. But gradually, technology improved. It was possible to remove lead.
Yeah.
And the driving force really was the health impact of lead. It wasn't just in petrol. Lead was also in paints.
Yes.
You know, lead paints. And it used to be everywhere. Now, because it's out, used widely, you know, domestically as well as in fuels and so on, it eventually got into the dust that we breathe and so forth.
Yeah, so it's so, just...
Yeah.
Amazing. I'm going to have to let you go there, Ogo, but that's been absolutely fascinating.
Okay, the other one was about sulfur. I didn't know if you wanted to talk about sulfur.
We've got 4 seconds, Ogo. Bye-bye. Okay, thank you.